And welcome to another edition of Shedding Light here on KZSU. I'm your host, Bird, and joined today once again by Director of Peninsula Peace and Justice here on the Peninsula in Palo Alto, Mr. Paul George. Paul, welcome back to KZSU.
Oh, as always, glad to be here.
Great to have you, and
happy dog days.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, a lot going on. I mean, things are a little slow in a lot of different ways. You know, Andrew Card said just before 9/11, that was George Bush's, one of his boys, said we never roll out new products in August.
Right. Well, that was the August before the invasion of Iraq.
There you go.
That was in August 2002.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good memory.
Yeah, good marketing.
Yeah exactly. But now today I heard that the president has come out in favor of Gulf Coast seafood. And he's actually going to eat some himself. And he said, nobody be alarmed. Everything's cool. You can eat the seafood again. Everything's fine in the Gulf.
Yeah, well, apparently the New Orleans Saints are visiting the White House today, and they brought along some of their
for real?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. This is why it hit the news. And they brought along some of their favorite recipes to kind of promote Gulf seafood. There are areas that apparently weren't affected, and they've been fishing all along.
Yeah.
I don't really know enough about it to...
Right.
You know, I'm not ready to run out and have some Gulf shrimp myself.
But, yeah. Well, not just that. We do know one thing for sure, that they showed the pictures of the cans that the toxic dispersant came in.
Right.
It was 50-gallon drums, and there was like a skull and bones or some kind of real evil... toxic hazardous waste warning on it. Not waste, but a warning on it, saying, don't get this on you, don't let it touch you,
right.
Don't breathe it. Yet they were spraying this directly into the water, and some millions of gallons have been sprayed into the Gulf, right?
Yeah, and, you know, they're not being real forthcoming about what this dispersant is supposed to do. And also, they've used it in such quantities and at such depths because of how deep this well was.
Mm-hmm.
No one's ever used it there before. And so, you know, we don't really know what the effects are. And they sure aren't talking about it.
And I think you said the magic word right there, because when I heard the president come out and say that today, I thought, wait a minute, all the scientists say they really don't know. It's going to take a while. So why should the president come out and say, oh, everything's cool, don't worry about it, plug the leak, it's all good now. It's almost like he's working for BP.
Well, I don't know. So these are some of the things that presidents have to do. So promote consumerism. You remember George Bush after 9/11 telling everyone to
George
go out
Jr.
and
go shopping.
Go shopping.
And go down to Disney World.
So,
I wonder what would happen.
The Louisiana economy has been devastated by this.
It sure has.
In addition to just the normal wreckage of our economy these days.
And it should get that $20 billion. As a matter of fact, it should get more than that, right?
Yeah.
It should get whatever it needs. President Obama said, we won't stop at $20 billion. We'll take whatever we need to restore the entire Gulf Coast back to the way it was before the oil spill. Now we find out today that the $20 billion hasn't even been put up yet. They just barely put up $3 billion over the weekend, and they're kind of hemming and hawing and going, well, we'll put up this money right now, and then, you know, we'll see what happens and let people make their claims. And it turns out people aren't even going to get all the money they deserve. They're going to get like 20 cents or 30 cents on the dollar.
Yeah, it's, you know, my biggest concern is that it's going to be tied up for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Because already there's three major players in the Deepwater Horizon platform. There's a corporation called Transocean, which actually owns the rig and was leasing it to BP. And there's BP, and then there's
Halliburton,
who
they were responsible for plugging the well.
They screwed up in the failsafe device down at the bottom, apparently.
Well, all three of them point the fingers at each other, saying,
right.
it's all the other guy's fault.
Yeah, and it's going to end up in court,
mm-hmm.
And we know how long that process takes.
20 years.
But, the $20 billion that BP promised was, I thought, a pretty good move by Obama to pressure him into doing that. And it was so public that they would have trouble reneging on that at this point. But $20 billion may not cover it.
Right.
And meanwhile, we have the Senate just packed up and left Washington last week after the Republicans blocked any work on a bill that would lift the liability limits for such oil disasters.
Oh, really?
So, you know, that's sitting out there, and who knows if the Senate's going to act on it when they get back.
You know, I'm in my 50s. I don't think I've ever seen a time in my lifetime.
Boy, I would have guessed you to be 30 or so.
Thank you, Paul. I appreciate that. I've never seen
lack of hair. And
well,
stuff.
Thank you. Well, that's from wearing too many hats. I've never seen a time in my life, though, that the government has so blatantly been just out front in being bought off by the corporations, completely being owned lock, stock, and barrel, whether it be the pharmaceutical companies when we tried to pass health care, whether it be the oil companies during this oil spill, whether it be every time we turn around nowadays, we just see the banks got all that money. All the banks that just robbed the United States got all that money in that bailout. And did they help the little guy? Did they come back and help the little businesses in the United States? No, you can't get a loan.
No, but, you know, it has been that way for a long time. I mean, you
never so blatant, though. Never so out front like this.
Well, it has changed. I mean, let's remember, first of all, it was Eisenhower when he left office back in the 50s.
He warned
against the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons why it may be so more obvious and blatant these days is that the banking industry has changed so much with Bill Clinton's deregulation back in the 90s. Where they were able to, Wall Street bankers got into all these exotic investments. And, you know, the nature of banking has changed. It used to be, banking still is critical to the way the economy works. They move the money around.
There used to be rules.
Yeah.
There's not anymore.
But the level of the economy that is now tied to these various toxic and exotic investments has something like gone up 400% in the last 10 years since Clinton deregulated. And so
even that new bill, did that new bill outlaw any of that kind of practice? I don't think it did. The protections bill that they just passed a couple of weeks ago?
No, but it has restricted it.
Very minutely, because Russ Feingold from Wisconsin wouldn't sign on to the bill, saying that it really didn't fix the real problem.
Right. It doesn't. It's, you know, there's good stuff in there. But again, you always have to keep in mind, you know, there's an opposition in Washington now like there's never been. The Republicans have made a decision that they're just going to try to stop anything the Democrats and this president try to do. It's a political strategy to regain Congress and regain the White House.
Try to turn Obama into a one-term president, right?
Yeah. You know, if they just disagree to go along with anything, he will be a failed president. And they'll, you know, go marching back into the White House. This is the theory. You know, one of the things I brought along today kind of speaks to this. We had talked about just kind of going through the New York Times and seeing what was in the news, but you know, I realize it's Monday, there's not much in the news here today, but there's a really good article by as usual by Paul Krugman, the Princeton economist, Nobel laureate for economy, and it's called America Goes Dark, and he's it's one of his more despairing columns, and he's been despairing. And
is he getting a little jaded, a little down and out?
I think he's freaking out at the obstructionism of the Republicans in Congress and this anti-government mood. And right at the time when we actually really need the federal government to be engaged in stimulus spending. I mean, but let me just read a couple of these things.
Please do.
Because I won't read the whole thing, but there's a few paragraphs here that I think really make you kind of wake up to what's going on. It's called America Goes Dark. Quoting, the lights are going out all over America, literally. Colorado Springs has made headlines with its desperate attempt to save money by turning off a third of its streetlights. But similar things are either happening or being contemplated across the nation, from Philadelphia to Fresno. Meanwhile, a country that once amazed the world with its visionary investments in transportation, from the Erie Canal to the interstate highway system, is now in the process of unpaving itself. In a number of states, local governments are breaking up roads they can no longer afford to maintain and returning them to gravel. Now, is that incredible?
Yeah.
So Krugman goes on, in a nation that once prized education, that was among the first to provide basic schooling to all its children, is now cutting back. Teachers are being laid off. Programs are being canceled. In Hawaii, the school year itself is being drastically shortened, and all signs point to even more cuts ahead. And he goes on to talk about, you know, the need for spending right now, stimulus spending, the tax breaks for the wealthy that Bush passed early in his term. And this is going to be a major debate when they come back and when Congress comes back in September, because the Bush tax breaks expire at the end of the year. And so they're going to, you know, have to work on it.
Well, either to keep them. Or to let them go, right?
Right. And, you know, what Obama wants to do is keep the tax breaks for the middle class and folks making under that, and roll back the tax breaks for the wealthiest. And the Republicans are insisting that tax breaks for the wealthy are stimulus spending. They want everything else paid for by balancing the budget, but they claim that tax cuts somehow, because they're stimulative, do balance the budget. It's all crazy.
It's insane.
We're talking about $700 billion in taxes on the wealthiest Americans,
mm-hmm.
but it's this whole attitude of the neoconservatives to shrink government as much as possible, this anti-government activity, coming right at the time when we most need the federal government to be the most active. So let me just go back to Krugman's words here.
That was from today's New York Times?
This is today's Times, yeah. And this is how he finishes it up. How did we get to this point? It's the logical consequence of three decades of anti-government rhetoric, rhetoric that has convinced many voters that a dollar collected in taxes is always a dollar wasted, that the public sector can't do anything right. The anti-government campaign has always been phrased in terms of opposition to waste and fraud, to checks sent to welfare queens driving Cadillacs, to vast armies of bureaucrats uselessly pushing paper around. But those were myths, of course. There was never remotely as much waste and fraud as the right claimed. And now that the campaign has reached fruition, we're seeing what was actually in the firing line. Services that everyone except the very rich need. Services that government must provide, or nobody will. Like lighted streets, drivable roads, and decent schooling for the public as a whole. So the end result of the long campaign against government is that we've taken a disastrously wrong turn. America is now on the unlit, unpaved road to nowhere.
The last time you were here, Paul, you warned us about the vote that was coming up. The Senate and the Congress are going to vote $33 billion to extend the Afghanistan illegal occupation.
Right.
Can't call it a war anymore. It's an illegal occupation. We shouldn't even be there. And what's amazing is, then, right after you were here.
Let me just jump in. You do have to call it a war, because a lot of people are dying.
I always thought a war was between two armies. You know, even Vietnam kind of had a formidable army that they fought the United States with.
Right.
It was an insurgent army. It appears as though these Iraqis, these Afghanistan folks are people that live there, and they're reacting to being occupied like they did with the Russians. But Whether we call it a war or an illegal occupation, what amazed me was, since then, the unemployment bill came up, where people's unemployment had run out. And even as late as this weekend, I saw saw senators and congressmen on the weekend talk shows going, "We can't afford to extend these unemployment benefits. This is just horrendous. This will bankrupt this country." But these same guys just voted $33 billion that we don't have to fund this fiasco. Let's just call it that. This thing over there where so many people are dying. It's insane. What's your take on that?
Well, this really points up the hypocrisy of the Republicans, who are insisting only sometimes that everything be paid for. Mm-hmm. And let's understand, there's nothing wrong with the federal government running a deficit. It can be paid off. The deficits in the past have been paid off. The budget has been balanced. America's credit is still good. And this is the time, this is the role of the federal government, is to be borrowing that money on our behalf. The states, as Krugman points out in this column, the states are really struggling because states can't have unbalanced budgets. They can't run deficits. Only the federal government can do that. And the states really need help. We know that all too well here in California.
Yeah.
And it's a, you know, that the ripple effect when states have to lay off workers, stop building projects, lay off teachers, those people are no longer spending money, and that has an effect on the corner grocer and the clothing store and all the other things. And, you know, for the Republicans to be standing in the way of more stimulus spending, the original stimulus was far too little, but I think it can be shown that it did have a positive effect on the economy. But the signs right now are clear that there's another recession coming. The recovery, so-called recovery, is really sputtering. And so this is the time. We learned this in the Great Depression. They made the same mistake back then, and that's why I can't understand why the people in Washington can't learn from history.
Could it be they don't want to? Could it be that somebody really wants to tank the American economy and turn it into a third world country with the elite class up above and then the serfs down below? Are there people that want to eliminate the middle class?
Well, those have been the policies in place for a long time.
So that must be it then.
The middle class has been sinking further from the middle. The income gap in this country has been increasing with fewer and fewer people holding more and more of the wealth.
Shouldn't both sides be blamed for that too?
But the real agenda here, again, is not not to purposely tank the economy. The agenda here for the anti-government people is to tank Obama and tank the Democrats and just lay everything around their necks. And if it means tanking the economy to do that, then they're apparently willing to run that risk to take back the House.
Where does it feel like the American people are?
Well, you know, we get a lot of reporting about the Tea Party, but they're a pretty small fraction of the entire electorate.
A sliver.
People are obviously concerned about the economy. There are so many people unemployed and so many people losing houses that it's the kind of thing that does cause a backlash in elections. Elections are, you know, the old saying goes that the elections are always about the economy. They're always pocketbook issues. And we are in a period where pocketbook issues predominate.
Sure. And the Democrats could be blamed for it. What's your take on the media? Because it seems like, to me, I do watch the mainstream media on purpose. I even watch some Fox and I watch some CNN and some MSNBC just to see what they're doing and talking about. And it seems that there's one main thread that runs through all of it. They follow the Tea Party. I'm glad you brought that up. And they follow Sarah Palin. like she's somebody to follow. Like, we should be listening to what she's saying. Why does the news media focus on these two things that really don't have that much to do with what America's really thinking?
Well, at least for television, it's good video. These Tea Party crazies out there with their signs and costumes and stuff, it you know, visually,
it sells soap.
They're good images. Sarah Palin is a celebrity, and you know, the media loves following celebrities.
Is she really though? I mean, Sarah Palin, you know?
Well, you know, maybe
celebrity?
not to you and me.
Okay.
But
you think the media helped make her a celebrity? You know, when the media can turn the lights off too, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
They could ignore you and then you won't even be known about. But if they put the light on you, and you know, we get this every week. There's a new little scandal or this or that, and the media will shine a light. Remember Joe the plumber?
Yeah.
Who knows where he is now? And nobody knew him before. But when Obama walked up to him and he talked to Obama, and then McCain knocked on his door, all of a sudden Joe the plumber was the most famous guy in the world for about, he got his 15 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, 6 months or a year.
Andy Warhol was right. Well, you know, yeah.
You think the media plays a role in shaping our, you know, how we perceive politics and how we're looking at things?
Well, certainly. And you know, we're talking in very broad strokes here.
Sure.
But the media, for example, tends to emphasize the horse race aspect of politics and not the issues.
Yeah.
You know, who's up, who's down, you know, what are the polls saying this week? But meanwhile, people aren't getting the policy discussions that they need.
But just to be fair, what media do you rely on for the truth? And I know guys like you and me who care, and I know there's a lot of us out here, there is media we can go to. Let's mention that, because I mentioned all the other ones, the CNN, the Fox, all that. But what media do you go to get some truth?
Well, there's a lot of different sources.
What's the ones you get up every day and you make sure you check out?
Well, first of all, you know, I subscribe to the New York Times at
home. You trust them?
Yeah, there's good reporting in the Times.
Yes, sir.
There's some terrible op-ed stuff, and, you know, there are reports that I would pick with, but
overall they're pretty good.
But the thing, what I wanted to get to, I was just starting with the New York Times. You have to build a big picture. And one of the interesting things is to read an article in the New York Times, and then read the same story in The Guardian from London, and you'll see different takes on it.
Kind of like Al Jazeera and Fox.
Yeah.
Right?
But I do look at Al Jazeera on the web. I go to a lot of different websites and blogs, and you just have to build a big picture. There's no one source that I would say is truthful.
Do you put links up on the Peninsula Peace and Justice website for links like that? Could people go to a website like yours and find some good media?
One of the things that we do, we have over 12,000 articles archived on our website.
Mm-hmm.
Every day, Monday through Friday, myself and a volunteer editor go around a lot of these different sources that we look at and pick out about 6 or 8 articles that we think are really good or commenting on news that's currently in there. And those are posted right on the homepage. And then right in the center is the pick of the day, the one I think is the most significant article of the day.
What'd you pick for today?
Today was an article from the latest issue of the New Yorker magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a reflection on the WikiLeaks documents.
Oh,
because, well, talk about mainstream media and how they tend to spin things.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just the media in this case. When the WikiLeaks document dump came out, you know, all these documents about Afghanistan.
2 weeks ago today. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of official Washington's immediate response was, well, there's nothing new here. We knew this stuff. We knew civilians were getting killed and that sort of thing. And
we knew Pakistan was helping the Taliban. And we knew that innocent women and children were dying needlessly. Everything in those reports, right?
Right.
Yeah, they said they knew it all.
So this article from The New Yorker, written by Amy Davidson, says there is some truth to that fact. But then she goes through a particular story of a police chief who had been accused of raping a 16-year-old Afghan police chief. And someone came to stand up for her, and he was killed by the police chief. And she picks out, the basic point is she picks out a lot of detail and says, these details do matter because it's our presence and our arms that are making it possible for a police chief in Afghanistan to rape a 16-year-old and get away with it.
Or we're supposed to, we all thought we're there to stop that.
Yeah.
Our presence should be stopping that, right?
So, you know, I thought it was a really, really good piece because...
And where did that appear?
It was in the...
New Yorker magazine?
New Yorker magazine, the most recent issue that just arrived in my mailbox over the weekend sometime.
In case you just tuned in, we're in conversation with Peninsula Peace and Justice Director Paul George, based right here in Palo Alto. And, Paul, you it's kind of a slow time for Peninsula Peace and Justice right now. You guys don't have any too many big events coming up. But
not until September. But,
yeah, and then it's going to hit the fan. You got Robert Fisk coming in, Robert Scheer.
First, we've got Robert Scheer on September 11th, as a matter of fact.
Nice date.
And that's a Saturday night, and that's going to be at the Unitarian Church over on Charleston. And Bob has a brand new book coming out called The Great American Stick-Up. And it's about the financial crisis and or the economic crisis and
the stick up
and you know how the deregulation during the Clinton administration really led directly to this collapse, this casino economy, and how some of those same people are now in the Obama administration making economic policy.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it's disturbing that, but that seems to be the way Washington works. They keep going back to the same people, and they keep making the same mistakes over and over again.
Well, what it is though, I really, more and more, I'm beginning to see it's us. We keep repeating the same thing. We keep putting the same people in. When change comes, we got fooled by Obama. We were so ready, willing, and able to embrace a new African American president. We didn't really look at what he was saying and what he was doing. Well, a lot of us got caught up in the, oh, wow, the first African, we'll be post-racial. And this morning I saw Cornel West with an op-ed on Free Speech TV saying, Mr. Obama, we're disappointed. I'm behind you, brother, but you know what? You're not doing the right thing. You got the wrong people in place. And when Cornel West is criticizing Barack Obama, you know something's wrong.
Yeah, well, I think we're all disappointed in some aspects of Obama, and perhaps we expected too much. I think what the lessons of the last year and a half are is I think he genuinely thought he could come to Washington and change things. And he gets there, and it's awfully hard to do, especially when you have an opposition party, as we were talking about earlier, is willing to risk the entire economy, the livelihoods of millions and millions of Americans, to make a political point. That's it. Washington is still dysfunctional. And I don't think you can lay all the blame at Obama's feet because he has met a brick wall from January 20th on.
How about some of his appointments, though? Did he have to have Larry Summers as one of his main financial guys?
Right. Well,
did he have to have Janet Napolitano, Little Miss, right out of Arizona, right out of the Patriot Act, did he have to get her?
Well, the worst thing about Napolitano is that it left Jan Brewer in charge in Arizona.
Thank you.
See where that has worked out. You know, any president is going to make appointments that you're not going to be happy with. And
what do you wonder about those appointments? Were you questioning the whole thing when he started doing that before he got into office? You know, he had to start making appointments.
That's been true of every Democratic president I can remember since I've been politically aware.
Making strange appointments.
Why are these people being appointed? Yeah,
and what do you think it is?
Larry Summers was.
He was the architect
really
of this
pick.
Latest thing, this latest mess that we're in, right?
He was one of them.
Yeah, definitely.
Larry Summers, and he was Robert Rubin. These are some of the people Bob Scheer is going to be talking about.
Now, there's speculation on the street that this new commission that's going to checking with Alan Simpson, the ex-Wyoming senator. Barack Obama has his little commission, and they're going to check on the deficit, and they're going to come in with a report in December. And the speculation is there's a big move afoot to paste a Social Security as a failed program, which we all know it's not, and to try to get rid of it, to try to either privatize it or to just say, well, it's broke, it's broken, it's going to break, so let's change it. Let's order at least raise the retirement age. Have you heard about this?
Sure. There's been a lot of speculation along those lines about this commission, and my reaction is I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, the commission's going to come out with a report.
Well, yeah, they are. But let's remember that when George Bush was in office, controlled the Congress, he wanted to privatize Social Security.
He tried.
And he had the Congress with him, and it didn't happen.
That's true.
People really value Social Security. And I don't think this commission is going to have enough oomph to change that equation. And I don't think Obama or the Democrats are going to be very willing to go along with the commission that says, let's destroy Social Security. There are some pretty easy fixes for Social Security, I think. You know, right now, I don't remember what the numbers are, but if you're making enough money, at some point you hit a cap in your annual salary. It's up around $150,000 or $200,000 or something, and Social Security stops coming out. So for those of us who aren't making $150,000, we're paying Social Security all year long. 12% of our income goes to Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
If you're making, you know, $500,000 a year, that percentage is not 12% for you. Because it stops when you hit $150,000. It's more like 2% or 1% of your income you're kicking into Social Security. So either raise that cap or eliminate it. You know, if
make it the same percentage across the table for everybody.
Yeah.
Whether you're making $1 million a year or 20 bucks.
Right. And that would be a lot of money.
But is there political will for that? We both know there isn't. Because who controls both houses of Congress? Rich people.
Well,
right?
That's true. But, you know, public pressure, you know, from the grassroots does work, as I say time and time again here. There will come a time when they realize something has to be done about Social Security. The books aren't going to balance at some point down the road. And it's not dire and it's not drastic right now.
One of the
reasons this commission is thought to be looking at Social Security is because the money in the Social Security accounts is being fudged and used to kind of balance off the books. And it's not being left in remember Al Gore's lockbox? Well, you know, Al had kind of the right idea that you have to take that off the books. This is a, you know, its own program, and you have to isolate that money.
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth, because I was just about ready to bring up the fact that I do have a little bit of a memory left. And I remember the 70s and the 80s, and even in the 90s, the Congress and the Senate were robbing borrowing from the Social Security Fund, because it's been fat with cash forever. It's got more money in it than, you know, it's loaded, right? And they've been borrowing from it and laying IOUs on it. And when they talk about it, oh, it might go broke in the next 25, 30 years, they're not mentioning the fact that they borrowed from it and never paid it back.
Yeah. Well, that's one problem. And, you know, there are some structural problems that need to be addressed.
They quit borrowing from it.
Well, we've got the Well, that's one thing, but we've got the baby boomer generation getting ready to retire, mm-hmm. and that's going to be a big hit on Social Security.
Sure, if they put that money back that they took from it, it would be just fine, wouldn't it?
Well, that's not clear that that's the case.
Really?
So some structural things like raising this cap that I was talking about or eliminating the cap
mm-hmm.
would may still be needed sometime in the future, but back to your core question, I don't think there's going to be anything that Congress will do that will really
devastate Social Security.
The Republicans tried when they were in control, and it just didn't happen. And that was because of pushback from the people, from us.
Right.
And that was pretty clear. And that hasn't changed. People like Social Security. You know, even if you're not collecting it, you can see the benefits to your grandparents or your parents or whatever.
If there's some way they can paint it like a broken program or like it's not going to work, you know, that was part of, Bush wasn't coming out with that message. He wanted to privatize it and take it into the stock market. And right. he was enticing everybody with, hey, you might make more money.
Yeah.
It might be better.
Yeah.
But if something was through the media, you know, I kind of do hear this as a little tiny voice coming down the pike from the media that, oh, in fact, I heard over the weekend, I think I heard it on CNN. For the first time, Social Security posted a deficit. They had a problem making their payments, you know. And we both know that the media is into mass manipulation. They're into doing things like following Sarah Palin or, you know, doing things that just aren't well, they're a little skullduggerous at times. And if they were to get on a campaign of trying to paint Social Security as, well, it's just not going to work anymore. There's too many people. The baby boomers are coming. If they got that negative idea going, they might just be able to push it off the cliff and get the people to go along with it.
Well, that's what the Republicans are pushing.
Are the Democrats involved in that at all?
Not most of them. You know, some of the so-called blue dog centrist Democrats that are such a thorn in the side are probably in that camp as well,
mm-hmm.
but you know it goes back to this ideological opposition to the government and activist government, federal government on the part of the neoconservatives. They want to reduce the size of government as much as they can
to be able to drown it in a bathtub.
Right, as the old saying
was that
goes.
Porter Goss?
No, that. It was right on the tip of my tongue. But
the other one.
You know, as long as we're on Social Security, there's just kind of an interesting bit of history about it. When Roosevelt was first proposing Social Security,
mm-hmm.
He sent out political cohorts around the country to try to sell it. Because people were, you know,
skeptical.
They didn't want more money coming out of their pockets and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they sold it as they kind of used the analogy of a fire department to sell the program, that this is something we all do collectively for the mutual good of everybody in the country. We fund fire departments. If your house never caught on fire, it's still beneficial to you to be financially supporting a fire department.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is what the Obama administration needs to do with stimulus spending is to remind everybody that this kind of I've got mine attitude, if it's allowed to spread, you won't have yours for a long time because, mm-hmm. you know, tens of millions of unemployed and mortgages going underwater will eventually affect all of us, even if I've got mine right now. And he has to demonstrate to people that these are the things that this is why we have a government, is to work collectively for the betterment of the entire society. And that goes to things like Social Security, stimulus spending, where we started off this conversation, keeping teachers employed.
Mm-hmm.
The House is running back to to vote on a bill that the Senate finally passed, put up $28 billion
to save the teachers'
to
jobs.
Save the teachers. When that bill started in the House, it was $50 billion. So, you know,
they know how to chip away at it. Seeing Obama's behavior for the last year and a half, do you really think even he might have the political clout or will to do something like what you just said?
Yeah, I do. I do.
Really?
Yeah.
Cause, where's he going to get it from?
Well, I think this is his real strength, and that he hasn't used the bully pulpit, as they call it.
And since he hasn't, what makes you think he's going to now?
But he's starting to. When he was recently in Detroit and toured the Ford Motor Plant, I thought that was one heck of a speech that he gave, and he really took the Republicans to task on their economic policies. And I think we're going to start seeing more of that. I certainly hope so. And that he'll be out there and active, especially with the midterm elections coming up in November.
I think
that still remains his strong point.
His bully pulpit?
Yeah, and it really is the strong point. It's the major thing that any president has that no other politician has.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if he speaks, he's on the news nationwide.
That's how Reagan got a lot of stuff done. He would go directly on TV and talk directly to the people.
And with this obstructionist Congress, these Republicans, he's got to go over their heads and talk straight to the American people more about the things that I'm sure he knows, that we need more stimulus spending. This is not the time to reduce the deficit or try to balance the budget in Washington. This is definitely not the time. We did that in the 1930s.
He depends on Congress and the Senate to do
Roosevelt,
it.
You know, got his various stimulative programs started, and then everybody panicked about the deficit, and they stopped spending, and the recovery that had been coming just crashed again. And, you know, it sure seems we're headed right back to that sort of policy.
Sure. Well, that'll hand the White House possibly back to the Republicans in 2012.
Right.
Two more things before we run out of time. Immigration. What's your take on that? Obama, we know where the Republicans are at.
Right.
They're pretty much going along with Arizona. Some of the Democrats are. It's kind of a paralyzing thing because they're all kind of, especially the Democrats, they're afraid to touch it. It's kind of like the third rail because they want those Latino votes, but at the same time, they don't want to have to make that decision before the next election about what to do with it because they're afraid of ruffling too many feathers, right?
Yeah, well, there might actually be a bill that gets passed before the elections.
Really?
On not massive immigration reform, but a piece of it, and it's called the DREAM Act. And this is aimed simply at kids who came to this country undocumented when they were 16 or under, have been here for 5 years.
Or more.
Or more. Have graduated from high school and have done either 2 years of college or 2 years military service. Then under the DREAM Act, these students are set on the path to citizenship. It affects something like 700,000 students.
How far along is that bill?
It's ready to go. I believe the House, Nancy Pelosi, was hoping to get a vote on it before they broke for the summer. But again, the Senate is dragging its feet on it. But I think it'll come up. An interesting thing is that under Obama, the Immigration Service has stopped deporting students who are in this category, even though it hasn't been passed yet. The Republicans are saying, oh, they're trying to make law, but the Immigration Services has made a decision not to go after students who fit into this class of people. And even some of the students who are still undocumented, there have been a lot of protests on college campuses around the country in favor of this bill.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been, you know, symbolic civil disobedience, and a lot of undocumented students have been arrested during these actions. And they knew they were taking the risk of giving up everything they had. You know, some of them had been here since they were little children. They've gone, they're still in high school or they're in college. And by, you know, sitting down in the road, doing civil disobedience in favor of the Dream Act, they were risking it all. They were risking it all to be, get arrested and deported.
But did they really get deported?
And they haven't been. They've left them alone. So that's a really positive aspect. On the flip side of the coin, on immigration, deportations are way up under Obama.
Is it deportation, or aren't they taking them to secret, not secret, but for-profit prisons along the border?
Well,
holding them there as a crime of under the crime of being in this country illegally, isn't that going on a lot?
Yeah, and it always has. The detention system is a mess, and this is one of the things why we need immigration reform so desperately.
And I think a lot of Americans don't know about this. A lot of Americans think once they get caught, oh, we just send them back.
Yeah,
and we're not doing that anymore, are we?
Well, we never have. People get caught up in this detention system for a long, long time.
And these are for-profit prisons, too, aren't they?
And it's disgraceful. Yeah. Well, some are, some aren't, some
yeah,
are.
Yeah, which is very cockeyed. It's like, wait a minute, how do you decide where to send them? Are you going to send one to the for-profit and one to the other? And then there's a whole question of the federal government pays so much per body to these for-profit prisons, right?
Yeah.
Who is anybody checking to see how much they're spending on each person? So maybe they're getting $500 a day or $100 a day or whatever they're getting. Are they spending that $100, or are they, getting dried bologna and white bread and
they are not spending it. Some friends of mine who are active with a group called Multi-Faith Voices for Peace and Justice, actually got the Immigration Service to allow them to tour some of their facilities. They got in to look at them, mm-hmm. and talk to people.
What'd they find out?
It was terrible. It's just everything you would imagine.
We've heard it. No medical care. Quite a few have died.
Uh-huh.
Quite a lot have died, actually. You might even be in the hundreds from just no medical care. And nobody's checking up on this.
Yeah, it is a scandal. It's the way we're treating these people, and I like to think that maybe immigration reform will get done this time around. I have almost nothing ever good to say about George Bush, but his immigration reform bill that he put forward actually wasn't all that bad, and it's not that different from what the Democrats are proposing this time around, but he couldn't get it through a Republican-controlled Congress.
There's no political will.
But maybe if the Democrats can remain in control of Congress, we'll see something rational, because we certainly need it. It's unsustainable the way things are right now.
Totally insane. Just before we brought up immigration, you mentioned that bill that's Pelosi's calling everybody back for to vote on to try to save the teachers' jobs at $28
billion. Yep.
Now, Obama brought in his old buddy, Arnie Duncan, from Chicago. Arnie was very famous, got very famous for being a hatchet man and really slashing and burning when it came to public schools, and he loves charter schools. We know this. Obama put Arnie Duncan in charge of this new program. What's it called? Race to the Top?
Yeah.
And what this is it's some kind of carrot and stick deal where the states have to comply with whatever it is that they got their little program set out for, and to see if you get some money. You're like chasing this carrot on a stick, right? And a lot of it has to do with testing, doesn't it?
Yeah, thanks to No Child Left Behind.
Almost like the new form of No Child Left Behind, in a sense. And Obama put in his buddy Arnie Duncan. They're both in on it together. Obama knows exactly what Arnie Duncan's about. What's your take on this whole new attack on the American public school system, to the point where they have to try to get another $28 billion to save teachers' jobs?
Well, the $28 billion is, again, this situation where the states are in such such big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And the $28 billion is to cover what would be a state cost of paying for teachers. The money that didn't get passed by the Senate, by the way, was intended to help states with their Medicare coverage, because the states have substantial portions of Medicare to cover, and they don't have the money for that. But the Senate cut that part out because of a threatened Republican filibuster. So Ooh. That's why it's $28 billion instead of 50.
So what's your take on Arne Duncan and this new program?
I'll have to be honest with you, Bert. I don't follow the education issue as close as I probably should.
Mm-hmm.
And I really don't have enough detailed knowledge of it that I'd feel comfortable giving an opinion. I spend, you know, with our country at war in two different countries, and, you know, lobbying, flying predator drones in multiple countries around the country, and the economy. There's just some things I can't follow that closely. So
sure,
I'm going to take a pass on that. I do want to bring up something, though, before we run out of time.
Yeah.
I think it's important to remember and acknowledge that 65 years ago today, the United States dropped the second nuclear weapon in world history on Nagasaki, Japan, having bombed Hiroshima 3 days before on August 6th. So it's the anniversary of a very dreadful event, and there remains questions about whether it was necessary. And in all the reading that I've done, dropping those weapons and killing, well, in Hiroshima, something like 100,000 people were instantly killed. And in Nagasaki, somewhere around 40,000 people were killed instantly. And within 4 months, those figures were 170,000 in Hiroshima, 80,000 in Nagasaki.
Hmm.
And history looks back and says, well, Truman had the choice of either doing that or invading Japan and losing 1 million soldiers. And
is that the truth?
It doesn't seem to be from all the reading I've done. First of all, the Allied forces were engaged in a massive firebombing campaign over Japan. 67 cities were being routinely bombed. There was a total sea blockade of Japan. Japan was on its knees, and
weren't they asking to surrender?
They were in negotiations, and it seems like there would have been a direct possibility for surrender. The other thing is about the invasion aspect. There's nothing in history that says it would have had to been the U.S. to carry out a land invasion of Japan. Russia had armies nearby, and they were ready to invade. The bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I think, were the first shots in the Cold War that was going to develop right after World War II, that we wanted to demonstrate to the Russians that we had this new power. And the Cold War was on, and it's a sad commentary, but nuclear weapons are back in the news these days.
Aren't they, though?
And in good and bad ways. You know, this little mini START agreement that Obama worked out with the Russians is a positive step, even though it was a very small agreement to reduce nuclear arms. I think Obama is genuinely committed to doing what he can to reduce those arsenals in the time that he's in office. At the same time, we're still saber-rattling with Iran over their so-called nuclear weapons program, which doesn't exist. And things are pretty hot and tense with North Korea right now. So nuclear weapons remain the true hidden threat in this world. There are just thousands of weapons still around. We could kill humanity many times over, even though there have been substantial reductions. And
haven't we almost done that a couple of times? Didn't it happen in the Clinton administration? There was a mistake made. We came within about 15 minutes of full annihilation.
There have been several accidents, misreadings of radar and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
There was I'm not remembering the details. A particularly famous one where a Russian general realized that there was a misread on something that was happening.
And save the world.
And save the world, yeah.
Because it's all set up to go off automatically once they push the button, right?
There's too much automation.
Yeah.
This was one of the sticking points in the agreement that Russia and the U.S. worked out. This recent agreement was that for these interceptor missiles that first Bush and then Obama wanted to put in Poland and Czechoslovakia,
mm-hmm.
And Obama was trying to assure Medvedev that, these are non-nuclear, they're defensive. And Medvedev said, a missile on a radar doesn't tell us if it's nuclear or not.
That's right.
You know?
Right.
And so we would have to assume the worst. And that's why, we remain 65 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, still in a way on the knife's edge in terms of nuclear weapons. And
it's like we all got a gun at each other's head.
Yeah.
It's total insanity when you really think about it.
It is.
It is. And the average American doesn't even think about it every day. But if you dwell on it for a minute, we could all be turned into dust right now for nothing we did.
Yeah, it does seem to match the definition of insanity to have thousands of weapons that you cannot use.
Yeah, right.
Without destroying yourself. And the planet we live on.
Paul George, Peninsula Peace and Justice. The website is peaceandjustice.org. Paul, I want to thank you for your time. It's always great having you come down here.
I always enjoy it.
I do, too. In September, possibly we could get Robert Fisk in here. Maybe. I don't know. We'll try, but we'll definitely get you back.
Let's see. He is going to be in Sacramento, I think, that Monday.
Okay.
So that maybe on
we'll
the phone.
Some. Yeah, maybe we can do that. In the meantime, Paul, you take care. Thanks for all your great work. Keep it up. It's Peninsula. It's peaceandjustice.org. And keep the faith.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.